Before we start, please note that this podcast features sexually explicit content and descriptions of violence and crime. Over a century ago, Lancaster was a wide-open city for prostitution, liquor, and gambling, otherwise known as vice. City officials tolerated and even encouraged these activities. Police knew where the brothels were, but instead of shutting them down, they socialized with sex workers. The mayor himself was known as a live wire, whose philosophy was live and let live. In fact, there were several well-known gambling games within a stone's throw of his office. That all started to change in 1913, when four detectives came from New York and Rhode Island to Lancaster for an undercover investigation of vice. They were from the American Vigilance Association, which was an organization dedicated to eliminating prostitution across the country. These investigators left behind their accounts of their travels through Lancaster's hotel lobbies, alleys, bars, and brothels. They wrote detailed notes about their conversations with brothel keepers, who were also known as madams, waiters, sex workers, and bellboys. Their papers include 750 typed pages, photographs of sex workers and their houses, drawings of the layouts of brothels, and sex workers' calling cards. In addition, a local anti-vice agent who was not undercover kept copies of his handwritten notes about gambling, obscenity, commercial sex, and drinking in 10 bound books spanning from 1913 to 1917. These typed reports and handwritten books make up the Vice Files. Our goal for each episode is to introduce you to a person we have encountered in these unpublished files. The Vice Files often reveal secrets that a person hid from public view, or simply details considered too trivial for news reports. But these details help us to reconstruct a person's struggles and motivations, their sorrows and success. To us, these files are more than details about places and activities. They reveal people who wouldn't normally make it into the history books, or onto markers or monuments. It is worth getting to know them because they show how seemingly ordinary people navigated legal, political, and economic challenges, and how vice fit into people's everyday lives of work and play. Here is how each episode works. First, we present a profile of our featured person using public records, mainly newspapers from their lifetime, but also census records and court documents. The rest of the episode will focus on what the unpublished Vice Files say about the person. Meet Jenny Taylor, proprietor of an unlicensed bar and brothel. Meet Jenny Taylor, a fighter. Jenny Taylor was well known in Lancaster. She was a local celebrity, in fact, often featured in local newspapers, and accounts of her arrests for running a speakeasy and a brothel, and accounts of her as a victim of assaults, and stories of her retaliations, and in descriptions of her fights with police. Taylor was the daughter of David Bryant, who had been enslaved in North Carolina. He was part of a wave of formerly enslaved people who made their way to the North after the abolition of slavery. How exactly did he move from North Carolina to Pennsylvania? He joined with the Pennsylvania Volunteer 69th Regiment, which was fighting in North Carolina alongside Major General William Tecumseh Sherman's army during the Civil War. Sherman's famous March to the Sea was actually two separate campaigns. First, from Atlanta to Savannah in 1864. And later from Savannah through the Carolinas. On each march, Sherman destroyed food supply, building, and transportation lines that would have aided the Confederate Army. Along the way, enslaved people fled plantations to follow the army, or they met Sherman's troops in front of plantations, showing soldiers the hiding places of food or weapons, and offering up secrets to help Sherman's military campaign. Bryant was waiting by the side of the road when he met Edward Edgerly, a carriage maker from Lancaster and a captain in the 69th Regiment. He offered Bryant a position as a servant in his army. What a dramatic transformation! To be swept up by a liberating army which was destroying the structures of a slave society. But his recruitment into the 69th Regiment should not be seen as full emancipation. General Sherman himself did not accept black men as equals or as soldiers, but treated them as inferiors who served the white troops. Historians explain that formerly enslaved people probably felt exultation in joining up with Sherman, but also frustration in being mistreated by white troops. These promises of freedom and the realities of racism likely followed Bryant to Lancaster. David Bryant came with Captain Edgerly to Lancaster from North Carolina. In the late 19th century, he was one of approximately 50 black men in Lancaster who had been born in the South. The North was not an antidote to Southern racism. Here, Bryant would have found housing discrimination, where most black citizens were concentrated in the southeast of the city, limited employment options, and discrimination in public facilities. High rents in black neighborhoods made the economic circumstances even more difficult. There were also significant disparities in education. Black citizens in Lancaster had much higher rates of illiteracy, for example. Lancaster restaurants, hotels, theaters also sometimes refused service to black residents. For example, in 1919, a waiter told the minister of a prominent black church, Bethel AME, to take his meal to go. The minister replied that the only way he was taking his meal out was in his stomach. The waiter still refused to serve him in the restaurant because his boss told him not to serve any colored people. David Bryant's life in Lancaster was difficult. He lived in poverty, drank heavily, and went to prison twice, once for theft and once for assault. As we have seen in other stories from Lancaster Vice, many people in poverty supplemented their incomes with gambling, illegal liquor sales, and commercial sex, and some responded to the struggles for survival and everyday racism with the escape of drug addiction and alcoholism. David Bryant worked as a coachman and servant, which was common for black men in Lancaster. Only a few black men worked as entrepreneurs, such as barbers, or skilled laborers, such as coopers. By the early 20th century, he appears in the paper for altercations with family members and police resulting from his heavy drinking. In one case, Jenny Taylor and her sister-in-law called the police when he was intoxicated and violent in the home. Jenny Taylor's life follows much of her father's path. The census listed Taylor as a domestic servant in the early 1900s, but she participated extensively in the underground economy of vice. Black women faced greater restrictions on employment than white women and black men. They were overwhelmingly concentrated in domestic work and barred from sales jobs and most manufacturing jobs. Black women were cooks, laundresses, and caregivers. The work week was long, at least 6 days, and the pay was low. Her first husband, John Potts, reportedly died in 1905, and her younger brother, Alfred, died of tuberculosis in 1906 at age 18. Jenny Taylor married again, this time to George Taylor, a waiter from Philadelphia. This relationship was volatile. Neighbors reported many quarrels in the first few weeks of the marriage. When George left to stay at a hotel early in their marriage, Jenny tracked him down and assaulted him because she believed he was trying to run off. She said she was acting in self-defense. When the police arrived, Jenny kicked one officer in the stomach. George walked to Lancaster General to get stitches. 2 years later, when she was no longer living with George Taylor, a new suitor, Jacob Woods, cut her so badly that she needed 50 stitches. Woods was known as an old offender who had assaulted other girlfriends. Jenny spent months at the hospital and nearly died from an abscess on her lung. While she hovered between life and death in the hospital, her father turned her home into a liquor dispensary and was then charged with selling liquor without a license. Jacob Woods received a 4-year sentence for assaulting Jenny. While he was in jail, his brother Nick became romantically involved with Jenny. In this relationship, Nick was violent towards Jenny, like his brother was. There are reports of his assaults on her in 1910, 1911, 1912, and 1913. Taylor's father died in February of 1911. After this point, there was a change in Jenny Taylor's interactions with law enforcement. She was arrested repeatedly for violating liquor laws and keeping a disorderly house. A disorderly house was an umbrella category for houses that were loud and unruly, unlicensed bars, gambling dens, or brothels. The rise in arrests for liquor violations and charges of running a disorderly house might be related to her father's death. Perhaps Jenny struggled with the loss of his income, or the family's involvement with vice changed after his death, so that Jenny was no longer protected from these kinds of arrests. She endured other suffering as well. Her 18-month-old son, with Nick Woods, died of measles in 1912. After the death of her son, Jenny seems to have become more fearless, and she acted with increasing abandon. In 1913, she went to jail for 30 days for assault, and several months later was arrested for running a disorderly house. In 1915, she and her mother robbed a man passing their house, and she allegedly stole a children's bank with $5 in it from Nick Woods. One newspaper report described her as intimidating and combative. She has the reputation of being a great fighter while drinking and whips men when given the opportunity just as easily as she whips women. These newspaper accounts of Jenny's powerful fighting skills matched a trend in descriptions of black women in the press around 1900. Newspapers and travel guides for larger cities such as Chicago often presented images of black women in the vice underworld as predatory animals, and physically imposing criminals who preyed on naive visitors and police officers who tried to arrest them. This caricature of the ferocious black woman distanced black women from any semblance of femininity and discouraged white men from crossing racial lines for sex. The depictions also justified harsh police treatment of black women. Near the end of December in 1913, when it was well below freezing, Jenny ran out of her house wearing only an undershirt and a wrap with no shoes on. She was loud and intoxicated. A police officer came and told her to get dressed, but she refused and insulted him. He called for backup and they took her to the station. The newspaper described her uproarious behavior at the jail.
After keeping the rest of the lodgers awake by howling all night, Jenny's friend bailed her out and she walked home in her bare feet. At one time yesterday, the thermometer registered as low as 19 degrees and the sidewalks were cold, but Jenny did not seem to mind it.
Jenny did not seem to mind. This is a poignant line. She did not seem to mind it. On one level, this reveals the reporter's indifference to her suffering. On another level, it also suggests Jenny Taylor's defiance. Her toughness. Cold weather, police, and abusive partners could not deter her. How should we interpret her defiance and recklessness? Was her daring actually motivated by growing hopelessness and desperation? Perhaps hopelessness and defiance look similar in public accounts. She did not seem to be deterred by the surveillance of police. She was usually released on bail and then returned to the sex and liquor trades. But this changed in 1918, after the crackdown on vice in Lancaster, when law enforcement did not let her return home to vice. Police raided her North Street house in 1918 and found 14 men and women in the house, including white boys from Downingtown, a town 30 miles from Lancaster. Taylor was sentenced to 9 months in jail. Her sentence was longer than other women's sentences after the crackdown on vice began. Two white women, Amanda Brenneman and Lottie Main, served 3 months of jail time, each for running brothels in 1914. Black women in other cities were overrepresented among those arrested for prostitution. In the 1920s, when social worker Catherine Bement Davis studied women detained at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, she found that black women made up 13% of the inmates, while black people made up 2% of New York City's population. The racial imbalance in sex workers' arrests may be related to officials' stereotypes of black women as hypersexual and lawless. Black leaders accused police of making false arrests to disrupt black business and to paint black people as less moral than whites. Historian LaShawn Harris notes that black women faced police harassment and accusations of prostitution and gambling, even when they were running legitimate businesses such as beauty parlors. What do the unpublished Vice Files, the records of the anti-vice investigators, tell us about Jenny Taylor? Let's open the Vice Files and try to find Jenny Taylor. Despite the extensive press coverage she received over two decades, Jenny Taylor seemingly escaped notice of the anti-vice investigators. The undercover investigators in 1913 did not ignore black people altogether in their accounts of vice in Lancaster. The undercover investigators, for example, noted in passing the black women who worked as servants for the white brothel keepers. In vice and outside of vice, black women cooked and cleaned for others. The investigators also called on a black fortune teller, Thomas Wilson of Grant Street. The investigators visited and then described West Mifflin Street, North Street, and Howard Ave, where black sex workers, gamblers, and drinkers congregated. The houses in these areas were in disrepair. The transactions were often public spectacles, and the prostitutes catered to working-class customers. In contrast, accounts of white brothels in more affluent areas of the city emphasized domestic comforts, fashionable decorations, and privacy. One investigator, Jules Simon, described the decay and poverty of a brothel run by a black woman at 236 West Mifflin. Note that investigators referred to the prostitutes in the brothel as, quote, inmates.
The door to this house was open, and as the parlor is on the level with the street, everything could be seen in the parlor from the street. As I entered, I was greeted by an inmate who was much under the influence of liquor. About 50 beer bottles were on the table, full. This girl opened one and said, "This is on you, dearie." The place is filthy, rotten, dirty, and has a bad odor. An oil lamp on the table furnished light. Colored men were hanging around the open door and looked on while one of the inmates, who had just come in, undressed and stood in the room with the door open, no shades on the window, in more than semi-nude condition. The language used was the vilest. Little children playing about the house. I make oath, two little boys saw this woman in this condition. Such vileness and filth I never saw. I now believe what I've been told, that the houses on this street cater to the colored population. This street is a narrow, filthy, hilly alley, torn and holy. True conditions on this block must be seen to believe.
This is a vivid description of the working conditions at this house. However, the investigator does not report on the lives of the black men and women running the house and working here. Unlike their conversations with white brothel owners and keepers, the investigators do not tell us about black people's marriages, divorce, children, or grandchildren. In their conversations with white brothel keepers, investigators often sought more details about how their business worked and what their plans were for the future, under the pretext of wanting to buy into their business. Their conversations were shorter with the black brothel keepers, perhaps because it would not have been credible for a white person to be trying to buy into the commercial sex businesses on these blocks. There was likely more suspicion between the black proprietors and the white questioners, regardless of the investigator's disguise. On Sunday afternoon, on November 23, 1913, investigator Jules Simon went to 310 North Street, the brothel run by Nick Woods. City records tell us that Jenny Taylor was living with Woods around this time.
The door was open and I entered. There was no one in sight in the dingy, ill-smelling, filthy room except a sick child about 8 years old who was lying on a couch covered with rags. I asked the child whether a Mr. McCarthy lived here. The child called Mama a few times before the door of a side room opened and a colored man in his underwear looked out and said, "The missus will be in a minute." Shortly after, a colored woman came from the same room and promptly said, "Come on this way," indicating the way to another room. Although it was still daylight, it was almost pitch dark in this parlor.
Was it Jenny Taylor who entered the dark front room and beckoned Jules Simon to come on this way? It is hard to say. City directories indicate that Woods and Taylor lived together on North Street in 1913. But neither Woods nor Taylor had a surviving child around 8 years of age. Maybe the child was from one of Woods' previous relationships, and Jenny Taylor was helping to parent the child. Perhaps she was the mother he called for. And we have not been able to determine who Mr. McCarthy was. Perhaps he was a boarder. The darkness in the parlor, even though it was daylight, matches the knowledge we can gather about the inhabitants of the house. Not much information at all. But on a deeper level, the obscurity of this scene is actually revealing. Because in this scene, and in the many, many pages of the investigators' reports, Jenny Taylor remains in the shadows. Investigators may have met Jenny Taylor in this North Street house, but they say nothing more about her here. There is no other interaction with Nick Woods in the reports. Investigators never identify Jenny Taylor by name. Why was Jenny Taylor missing from the Vice Files? The efforts to clean up commercial sex and rescue women from sex work in the early 20th century often overlooked black women. Anti-vice investigators were often more focused on shutting down black-owned establishments that were popular with white and black customers. Racial bias was built into the anti-vice crusade in other ways as well. Reformers referred to prostitution as white slavery to convey the degradation of this labor, to equate it with chattel slavery. One of the main accomplishments of the fight against, quote, white slavery was the passage of the Mann Act in 1910. This was also known as the White Slave Traffic Act. This federal law made it a crime to transport any woman or girl for the purpose of prostitution or debauchery, or for any other immoral purpose. One of the most famous Mann Act cases was the conviction of Jack Johnson, the black heavyweight champion, for transporting a white girlfriend across state lines. Black leaders pointed to this case as an example of the racial injustices surrounding white slavery. Namely, that the history of white men's assaults on black women was overlooked and black men were punished for consensual relationships with white women. The racial frame of white slavery had other implications as well. When reformers and journalists expressed outrage about white slavery, they were interested in protecting the innocence of white women. Black women were assumed to be immoral, not innocent. Investigators in Lancaster documented their efforts to stop the slide of flirtatious young white women into full-fledged prostitution. They talked to white wage-earning women outside of movie theaters and restaurants at night to warn them about the dangers of sex work, encourage them to stay off the streets at night, and obey their parents. The Vice Files reveal that black women escaped this kind of protective surveillance. Unlike other people featured on the Vice Files podcast, Jenny Taylor gained notoriety in the press and was nearly invisible in the unpublished accounts of Vice. Newspapers created a caricature of her as a razor-wielding hellion, while undercover investigators did not pay attention to her at all, except to describe the dirty conditions of brothels in her neighborhood. Although much of commercial sex in Lancaster was racially mixed, there were racial divisions between cheap and respectable brothels, between women who deserved to be saved and those who did not. The layers of meaning attached to her, to heighten the impression of danger in the city, do not capture her sorrows and frustrations, let alone her hopes. As she aged, she receded from the spotlight. In the 1930s, she moved to Coatesville, outside of Lancaster, and died there on May 29th, 1941. Thank you for listening to this episode. Please listen to the other episodes of The Vice Files about Amanda Brenneman, Notorious Madam, Barbara Foreman, Charity Girl, and Kennedy Eckert, Young Sport. You can also learn more about these topics by taking the Lancaster Vice walking tour through the city. This podcast was created by Allison Kibler and a team of students from Franklin and Marshall College, Jaden LaCoe, Kylie Lockney, Rachel Rubens, and Dylan Sykes. Hope Glidden provided genealogical research. Narration by Rachel Rubens.